We just showed up consistently and with a lot of energy. You need a breakout success like Klaviyo. Here's what we're doing to try to be that.
How did you get them to care about Daniel? How did you get them to care about Eros?
They saw us being very active on social media, on YouTube, on content, and that awareness like helps people kind of go, oh, that team seems to be doing something different.
Why not be a customer onboarding tool for everyone?
We wanted to make it the obvious choice for some segment of customer. Narrow down to make sure we are serving one segment of customer super, super well, and then we can expand from there.
How have you thought about solutions partners and service providers? How does that fit in the mix?
We look at the agencies as a channel for our content. If we're educating them how to do things inside HubSpot and with their clients, they are consumers of our content, but also sending it to their clients also. And that becomes an opportunity for co-marketing.
Behind the scenes, it was a small group of people that were doing everything.
Slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
I want to know how this insane growth actually happens.
What are you doing when no one's around, no one's looking? Are you just showing up and doing a minimum? Or are you approaching it like a pro? Be a student of the game.
This episode is brought to you by Demandbase. Demandbase helps B2B companies hit their revenue goals using fewer resources by using the power of AI to identify and engage the accounts and buying groups most likely to purchase. Their account-based technology unites sales and marketing teams around insights that you can understand and facilitates quick actions across systems and channels to deliver big wins. It's flexible, scalable ABM built for you. Hello, hello. Welcome back to the GTM podcast. You got Scott Barker here. Appreciate you hanging out with us. As always, we've got a great conversation lined up. I'm joined by my man, Daniel Zarek. Daniel, what's up, man?
How's it going, Scott? Good to see you.
Good to see you on a Monday. How was your weekend?
Pretty good. Yeah. Good dog walk, wedding planning stuff.
Yeah. Nice, man. When are you getting married again?
In August. Yeah.
Nice. Nice.
We're like 90 days out. So it's like, ooh, crunch time.
Yeah. Crunch time. Building a business and planning a wedding. That's tough stuff.
Yeah. A lot of event planning this year with, and you know, company events, wedding stuff. It's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think you're a better wedding planner because you've planned big events and things for Eros and in the past?
Maybe a little bit, but also like, you know, coincidentally growing up when I was like 14, 15, like in high school, I booked shows and like planned event, you know, did a lot of event type stuff. And then in college, I was in a, I ran a student group and we did a bunch of event things. So, you know, I've never thought of myself as like an events person, but I've always done a lot of it coincidentally.
Yeah. Yeah. That I saw that in your background. So you were like 14 and you kind of like ran a record label or something. Tell me about that.
Yeah. A record label's a stretch, you know, but my very good friend and I, growing up, you know, we would go to shows in Louisville, Kentucky and see bands that we liked. And at one point, you know, he said to me, like, we could do that. Like, we could put these on. And so we just started going to, you know, you'd go to some church hall or some, veterans like hall and like rent it out for a few hundred bucks for a night. You'd go to a music shop and rent out like a PA system, go call some friends' bands. Occasionally some band would be touring through town, not like big ones, but you know, they might be on a record label, but still relatively small. And we'd go to Kinko's and print up flyers, put them around at coffee shops and school and, you know, get somewhere between 200 and 500 high school kids mostly out to shows and charge some money. And what, you know, started as that eventually led to, well, like our bands and our friends' bands wanted to put out albums, but we needed to have money to record, need to have money to like print the CDs or press them and all that stuff. And so we had money from booking shows and we just kind of like turned that into a record label at the same time with that cash.
I love that. Entrepreneurial spirit at a very young age.
Absolutely. My mom still has CDs, though, from that time in the basement somewhere. So, you know, it's not like we were super successful.
Yeah, yeah. That's awesome, though. That's cool. I had a similar, I think I was 17, 18, and, like, promoted all these shows at this, like, new club called the Electric Owl. And, like, I wasn't actually even old enough to go in. So, it was, like, it was wild. But it was good times. I love it. So, quickly for the listeners. So, Daniel Zarek is the co-founder and CEO of Eros. If you're not familiar with Eros, it's a collaborative customer onboarding tool built specifically for teams using HubSpot. Eros is funded by Gradient Ventures. We love Gradient. HubSpot Ventures, so that tells you a lot. And GTM Fund, we're super excited to be investors in Eros. And previous to starting Eros, you ran a design and growth agency called No Small Things and was a product manager at Twilio. Anything else in your background we should highlight?
That's the main stuff. I mean, yeah, I did a lot of design work for startups and then eventually Snapchat, the Obama Foundation. That's what funded Eros until we took the money from Gradient. And yeah, Twilio was there, employee 23 to 125. And I think they're, you know, leaving relatively early in this in the arc of that company is kind of an interesting learning for me as a 23-year-old back at the time.
Yeah, I imagine. Well, we'll wrestle with a bunch of that stuff. But what I want to spend, you know, the bulk of this conversation on is, you know, Eros is very intentionally and specifically built for, you know, the HubSpot ecosystem. And I think that that is becoming more and more common for new kind of SaaS companies to double down, triple down, kind of go all in on one ecosystem. Could be the Salesforce ecosystem. There's been some breakouts there. Could be the Shopify ecosystem, like folks like Klaviyo, who, you know, breakouts there. And then HubSpot feels like it is the next one that is going to foster some behemoth, you know, call them partner SaaS companies. But what is it like going to market in a single platform ecosystem? I feel like there's pros and cons to that, but what does it look like?
There's plenty of cons. We can talk there. It's interesting. You know, we've done it now just over 2 years. So, you know, we took the funding from HubSpot Ventures and you all over about a year and a half ago. And then it was about 6 or 9 months before that we launched in the HubSpot marketplace. And honestly, the first, I don't know, 6 months were really rough. We couldn't find our footing. We didn't know what messaging worked. And we took a very naive approach to how do you go to market in an ecosystem like this? We didn't, you know, we showed up with a great integration and we're like, great, promote us, like help us grow. And then they looked at us like, that's not how it works. You know, you need to go grow on your own and maybe we'll find ways to work together. And when we asked, you know, around, we're like, what's the playbook here? What's the go-to-market motion here? And nobody really had a good answer. It was early enough in the HubSpot ecosystem that there wasn't a playbook, there wasn't a go-to-market, so we had to go figure it out. And so, you know, like you mentioned, there are people starting to come into the HubSpot ecosystem, but, you know, even when we look around at Salesforce or, you know, which is the most direct comparable to HubSpot, it's another CRM, but the customer size is way bigger. The type of customer is very different. They're SMB versus, you know, mid-market enterprise. A lot of the motions are very different. You can't pull from Shopify or ServiceNow and like look at those ecosystems. You have to really develop for the platform you're on. And so that's been like a very big learning process for us in that 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And why even do that in the first place? Let's say I'm a revenue leader or maybe a founder and, you know, it seems like you're immediately, you know, cutting your TAM. Why not be a customer onboarding tool for everyone and play nice in the sandbox with, you know, every platform that people want to kind of integrate with?
Absolutely. I mean, we definitely cut our TAM off. So when we started, it was we did it for product reasons first. But when we made that choice 2 years ago, maybe a third of our prospects coming into the pipeline, very inbound pipeline, were HubSpot customers. A third were Salesforce customers. So it was pretty like equal. It wasn't obvious to go in on one. But we did it for the product reason because we wanted to shift the product to be very CRM focused. You know, if you close a deal, you need to then onboard them. And so where you're closing that deal, you're doing your CRM and you want to run the process more, you know, post-sales out of the CRM. So we did that first. And, you know, we thought, well, we wanted to make it the obvious choice for some segment of customer, like narrow down to make sure we were serving one segment of customer super, super well. And then we can expand from there. And so for us, it was, you know, not a, oh, we're narrowing our TAM forever. We're narrowing our possible like customer base. It's just narrowing for now to have stronger leverage, stronger momentum, serve a specific group of customers way better, way more deeply, and then leverage that later to jump to other platforms and other products. So, you know, for us, when we did it, it was very non-consensus. And I think a lot of investors, other founders assumed we were just trying to go be some add-on for HubSpot and like play in a smaller category. Whereas we looked at it as, well, this is going to be the dominant platform for startups and CRM, you know, mid-market customers, SMBs for the next decade. Don't we want to be a top five partner on that ecosystem? Do we want to leverage that to then jump to Salesforce later, where we'd have no advantages if we just started in Salesforce now? And so it was very strategic, even though it was smaller, you know, it did definitely limit things for us at first.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that was one of the things when we originally started talking that, you know, I was super impressed with is your, I think there was the two things that immediately got me like paying attention was one, you know, I think we can all agree CS is broken and doesn't get the love that it needs. You know, we all saw it through COVID and the churn rates going like crazy. And we weren't giving customers the love that we all said that we actually were, and we needed to build a better experience. And then the second was, you know, I'm super bullish. I think HubSpot just had their earnings come out. Like they're just crushing. And I think they're going to actually be one of the bigger beneficiaries of these advancements in AI because they're such a horizontal platform where so many actions are being taken both in their platform and their partner's platform, that those data points are going to help them build a very sophisticated, you know, LLM that is going to help the end user and the customer. And it feels like you've caught this ecosystem at its really early days, right? Like if you jumped in the Salesforce ecosystem right now, like good luck even getting someone on the phone, you know?
Yeah, there's no way to, it's a tall hill, tall wall to climb. You really need some leverage to make a splash over there. Whereas sales or with HubSpot, it's very early, even though it's 215,000 customers today, you know, it's a $2.5 billion ARR company, 30 something billion market cap. The ecosystem, the platform is still very early and there's actually a way to make an impact, you know, have a wedge in there. Like we have relationships with most of the execs there and most of the company because they're actually paying attention to and are looking to pay attention to small apps that are having an impact there. Because there's not like there's no breakout Klaviyo type success or DocuSign or Gainsight type success on their platform yet. They're looking for the people who are doing interesting things.
Yeah. And it's coming. Arrows is that. So I guess my question is how, because they're still a behemoth. How did you get them to care about Daniel? How did you get them to care about Arrows? You know, because you were a small fish. You said, okay, it's not super crowded yet. But man, there's so many competing priorities, partners, things going on. Was there a specific moment or tactic or something that you did that you felt like got them to wake up?
In many ways, I think they're still, you know, slowly waking up. So you know, systematic. It's, you know, piecemeal over time. So if you think about one of the first things we did was get the HubSpot Ventures investment, but even that took 5 or 6 months to close, you know, slowly building relationships there with the partnership team. And really it started first from having a strategically well-built integration. We used many components of the API. We really tried to put a lot of the, you know, workflow inside HubSpot to make the customer experience better. So everything kind of came back to, is this a better app or integration for our customers? Is this actually what we want our apps and our ecosystem to look like? So we started there. And then, you know, second, we were like, we need to get customers in this ecosystem. We need to go figure out what go-to-market looks like. And we started doing content. And that content really helped us, you know, show a new and interesting go-to-market in their ecosystem. We weren't just like cold calling people, but it was also visible. So a lot of HubSpotters, both individuals like AEs and CSMs to executives, they saw us being very active on social media, on YouTube, on and our content. And, you know, we kind of built up like a little mini brand in the ecosystem. And that awareness like helped people kind of go, oh, that team seems to be doing something different. Like there's an energy there. So, you know, as a startup, you know, you're getting people to buy in on your trajectory in a lot of ways. And I think the folks there, we just showed up consistently and with a lot of energy and a little bit of a, you know, fieriness, I'd say, like, hey, we're calling our shot. You need a breakout success like Klaviyo. Here's what we're doing to try to be that. You know, here's what we do for your customers. Here's the type of stuff we're doing on your platform. And here's where we're going. And, you know, I think they saw that kind of fieriness and were like, oh, this is interesting. I'll keep an eye on them. But then we kept following through. And that like was the first kind of thing that opened doors for us, and then eventually got the ventures investment. But really, the ventures investment then was just another like level. It didn't just magically start working after that. I took that as like a calling card and just went and opened up more doors. So, okay, I'll go reach out to this, you know, executive and use the HubSpot Ventures investment as a reason to get the meeting. But then it was all about, okay, here's how we help customers. Here's how we help you all, you know, with retention, or here's how we help you with expanding Service Hub add-ons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's always just been incrementally kind of opening doors and building relationships that have led to a really strong position that we're in right now, 2 years in.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very smart move to choose your kind of unique go-to-market differentiator around content, because HubSpot, you know, traditionally were the inbound, the content people. So they can see that, they relate to it, it has worked for them. So when they see other folks doing unique things that kind of fit their DNA, they're going to want to double down on that as well.
Yeah, but a very different type of content. So we weren't competing ever on, you know, SEO inbound driven content with like a lead capture in the same way that they were. You know, we've been very tactical, hands-on. We kind of call it HubSpot 201 content. So it's very much like how to do XYZ in HubSpot, you know, versus a lot of their stuff is much more, you know, SEO kind of here's lists and here's other things. And it led to an opening for us that we could actually come in and do something different, but in, like you said, the space that they understood.
How did you think about agencies? So I talked to a lot of startups, whatever ecosystem they're playing in, there's usually, you know, a huge swath of agencies, you know, Salesforce agencies, HubSpot, like HubSpot has a huge agencies business kind of built on top of it. And a lot of these folks do. And it kind of feels like people think that's going to be a silver bullet. Like, I do hear a lot of startups that I talk to who are like, yeah, we're going to go through this agency channel. And like, there's 12,000 agencies that do this. So if we just get 10% of them to do this, customers like, well, we're rocking and rolling. How have you thought about kind of solutions partners and service providers? How does that fit in the mix?
Yeah, I mean, definitely good luck to grow that way. I mean, you have to think about, I think it all comes back to understanding the ecosystem that you're playing in at its true fundamentals, right? So if you think about HubSpot, there's 215,000 customers today. They're, I don't know, something like half of them or 55% or something are global. The agencies, the solutions partners that sell services and resell HubSpot drive 40-something percent of HubSpot's own revenue. Like, they are selling it. So they're a massive channel for HubSpot. And HubSpot is attaching an agency to every new deal, basically, or 70-something percent. So agencies are a huge part of HubSpot growth. They've been there since, I don't know, 2011 or 2012. They've been there since pretty early on for HubSpot. So agencies are core, but also because of that, there's 1,600 apps in the ecosystem. Think of how many of those are going and knocking on the biggest agencies' doors and going, hey, you want to promote us? You want to sell us? And they're going, we don't care. Like, we've got our 10 companies we work with or 5 companies we work with. HubSpot's the main one. But beyond that, you know, goodbye. And so what we've found is that you have to understand their incentives and where they fit in. You know, so they're all trying to get new customers, new clients. So they're looking for new sources of leads and or new services that they're selling to them. If I can either charge my clients more, give them more services, and or reduce the amount of time I spend, you know, implementing the services I am selling them, that's where you have a lot of power with them. So for Arrows, you know, what we found is being a tool that's actually valuable for those partners to use and deeply embedded in the systems they're already using. So HubSpot, they all use their customers of, and they're onboarding people to HubSpot. A lot of solutions partners end up finding Arrows to be valuable for their own business. Secondarily, it's that content, you know, so we look at the agencies as a channel for our content. If we're educating them how to do things inside HubSpot and with their clients, they, you know, are consumers of our content, but also sending it to their clients also. And that becomes like an opportunity for co-marketing. And then that gives them ability to get more clients. And then ultimately, we're starting to work with them in a way where we say, here are the services you can sell to your clients if you bring Arrows into the mix. If you sell your clients Service Hub and you want them to know how to run customer success inside HubSpot, here's a way to do that. And here's what Arrows empowers you to do and how you would bring more, you know, problem solving capabilities to your customers. And then it's like that full like lifecycle part of it. And then Arrows is kind of, as a product, as an add-on, pretty far down the line. It's a lot of trust building. You know, only now are we really starting to do more with the solutions partners 2 years in.
And I think that makes total sense, is looking at them as more increasing your content distribution. You know, they're going to help with brand awareness. They can help you disseminate your thought leadership. And over time, that is going to bring them into the way you think, which will lead them to learning more about kind of your solution.
And actually, to build on that, you almost want them showing up on your door saying, how do we work well together? Because they see what you're doing is already great. And that if they're not a part of the Arrows game, then like they're going to be missing out or maybe falling behind. And so we early on thought solutions partners were going to be a big channel for us. And they weren't early on until they started being customers and are understanding Arrows and getting excited about it. And then they started saying, okay, how do we do more together? How do we work together in some way? I want to bring this to my customers. How do I know how to do that? And then we'll start to formalize it once it's like kind of getting pulled out of us, once there's demand.
And then going back to the mothership, so HubSpot, how are you extracting value from them today? Like, how much support do they give you? How much data do they give you? How much promotion do they give you? And how have you been able to increase that over time?
I would say much less of all of those than anybody on the outside probably assumes. And that's probably true, I think, for almost all the partner ecosystems that you look at. You probably assume that these ecosystems are giving a lot of love and a lot of attention to the apps and their platform, and they're likely not. Even the ones with, you know, when we took the HubSpot Ventures funding, other founders would ask me, oh, so do they just promote you like widely for that? And it's like, no, like you need to understand the size of an ecosystem or size of a company that runs an ecosystem like this. They're 7,000 or 8,000 employees. And, you know, the HubSpot Ventures team sits over here and the partner marketing team's totally across the org, and they don't interface very often, you know, and they don't take their priorities based on who HubSpot invests in, for example. And even the platform team that runs the marketplace, you know, doesn't control how sales gets enabled, right? They're totally separate organizations and that are, you know, running as their own little teams. Even sales isn't totally aligned. But what we look at on the outside is, there are, you know, something like 2,000 customer success people at HubSpot. There's 1,000 sales reps. You know, there's 3,000 or so plus total customer facing people there. Just like we talked about the solutions partners, our channel for our content is just as much that group of people who are talking to customers every day, trying to help them do things on top of HubSpot, either sell them more, you know, a new product that they don't typically buy, like Service Hub, or, you know, helping a customer in a situation set up a renewal pipeline, something they haven't typically done. And they go, oh, actually, Arrows has this awesome guide for that. So we look a lot at that channel as, you know, how we embed ourselves into the organization. And by, you know, kind of going top and bottom, both to executive level folks and, you know, leadership folks and getting embedded in certain programs that are happening, while also having the kind of lower level individual ICs know who we are and advocate for us internally. It's kind of reinforcing at both ends. So when a new program comes up that allows, you know, some app partner to get access to an early API before it's released publicly, we want them to go, oh, wow, you know, who should be on this list? Arrows. We see them hustling and we know they're in front of our customers a lot. And that kind of comes from doing both things. But there's nobody in any of these orgs that can put their thumb on the scale and say, all right, now we're just going to go promote Arrows. So it's really a, like, I don't know, hitting at all sides. But when we come back to things, and the advice we got really that has been most beneficial is like, go where there's demand. So for HubSpot specifically, you know, think of how, just like the solutions partners, their marketing team is probably asked by every partner to go send emails on their behalf. Please promote us. So it's like marketing has no demand for more app partners to come work with them. Whereas the individual CSMs, there's tons of demand there. They want, you know, knowledge that they can share with their customers. They need stuff to bring up with them on their calls that they have to do. They need more reasons to drive retention. And so what we started doing was going where there's demand in the org and stop spending our energy going where there isn't demand. So if marketing doesn't want to work together, we'll just stop. We'll wait till they come to us, just like the solutions partners, and we'll go serve the people that are showing up saying, hey, give me more. And that's been really helpful.
Smart. So does that mean like hand-to-hand combat? Like, are you meeting with strategic AEs and you're meeting with CSMs at HubSpot, like just ICs? You'll spend time in 30, 40 minutes? And
people would be blown away how much of my schedule and our team schedule is spent one-on-one with individual AEs or CSMs. And occasionally what happens then is that CSM or AE will go, hey, we do these lunch and learns. I think my team would love to see this. Did you want to come show this to my team? And we'll do a half hour, an hour long training session occasionally. But we get those opportunities by meeting one-on-one with individuals. And we've done that for 2 years now. And more, you know, we still do them and we still meet the, you know, individuals who have no idea who we are. A lot of times we'll do them and go, oh, I knew your content, but I didn't know what the product did. Really awesome to see a demo. Actually, I've got 10 customers or 5 customers who would be a great fit. I'd love to send this to them. You know, and now we have to still work on how we, you know, get the follow through on that. But without them having that one-on-one demo, they're never going to know when to bring it up to a customer. But it is a lot of hand-to-hand combat.
I love that. And that's great advice for anyone selling into an ecosystem or even just anyone doing channel or partner sales. Like if you are a partner leader and you're stuck with another partner leader at a SaaS organization and you're sharing target accounts and like that's all it goes, you have to spend time with the AEs at the partner organization and get to know them intimately because, you know, they can get their own training enablement material all day long, but we all know very few people read that stuff and they might have to sit through a 30-minute session, but they're not going to remember arrows until they meet Daniel or they meet someone on Daniel's team. And then when that problem arises, like, oh, I know personally someone who is world-class at solving this problem, and then they'll go do it.
And to that point, when we demo arrows to them, we're also demoing HubSpot because we're so deeply embedded. So they see us talk about HubSpot and use cases in HubSpot that they're not confident in. So they know, like, when customer success comes up with a prospect, oh, we should pull in arrows because they can help me sell this better than I can sell it on my own. And on our end, we know, you know, what CSMs are comped on, you know, what AEs are comped on, what their quotas are, which segment they sell to. We know the language they use to sell the different hubs at HubSpot. We know where they fit in, and we're feeding them, like you mentioned, enablement content, but also lines of questioning to take to their prospects. What happens when a deal goes to close one? What do you do now? What does your team do? And okay, that leads to a line of questioning that helps you sell Service Hub and post-sales stuff in HubSpot. And when we help them and train them on which ways to expand their sale to their customer, it also creates an opportunity possibly for arrows to come in and be attached to that deal. And that takes a lot of conversations to get to that point.
Totally. I'm hearing, like, which I think is brilliant, that you're almost positioning yourself as like solutions engineers or solutions consultants first, right? It's like, I know the person who can solve this problem. And by the way, you know, they happen to build really cool tech as well. But like this, bringing this person in is going to help me win this deal and upsell this deal.
We didn't start that way though. So that we've gotten there because early on we'd go to all these AEs, for example, and say, why aren't you attaching, you know, arrows or apps? Like, why don't you bring us into your sales process? And we heard a lot of times, like, we do not bring apps in. Like, you're just going to slow down my process. You're things I can't control. You're more people in the deal. I already have to attach a solutions partner because we have to have onboarding and all these other things involved. Like, I'm not going to pull you in unless it's like actually blocking me from getting the deal done. You know, like, if they're showing up going, I need CPQ or else I can't buy HubSpot, they'll go, okay, well, I'll bring in CPQ. You know, I'll bring in one product that helps me close this deal. And so unless onboarding or success is like a meaningful blocker, they're not going to bring us in. But what we've started positioning ourselves as, like you mentioned, is as a solutions engineer, as an enablement partner, when that use case does come up, because one, we will help them get the deal done, but also it's a way for them to expand the deal. So, like, hey, don't, you know, that thing, that part of that use case that you are not really confident in, here's how we actually help you accelerate the deal. And we always show up. And so it's just as much reputation as it is actually, you know, having them know about us. They need to see us show up on deals and actually accelerate things and always reply quickly, show up on the calls and demo really well. And that sort of word gets around. People share that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fantastic approach. All right. So what is the future of this? Like, are you going, I think, you know, it's starting with one ecosystem is like a forcing function for focus, which I think focus is like the most important thing for startups ever. So you have this beautiful forcing function of focus. Do you think that you'll stay focused on HubSpot forever? Is there enough meat on that bone? Are you planning to have, you know, HubSpot acquire you? Are you going to go and start building in other ecosystems? How do you think about the future?
Yeah, so we've always looked at HubSpot as a strategic launching pad for multiple products and multiple ecosystems. Like that's where Eros grows. But, you know, in a lot of ways, we're still constrained by being focused on one platform. But when I look at the other side, you invert that and you go like, well, have we actually gotten enough out of this ecosystem yet to leverage, to jump into other ecosystems? We haven't yet. You know, I got a great advice from Avanish. He was one of the HubSpot board members, but he built out Salesforce and Google Clouds and ServiceNow's platform ecosystem. And he always said, like, it takes 3 years for any partnership motion to really kick in. And we're just now having wrapped up our second year. So we're just entering our third year in this ecosystem. And, you know, this is the year where we really get to exploit all of the, you know, extract the benefits of all the work we've done the first 2 years. And in that first 2 years is really building relationships, sharing case studies, going to market together in small ways. And then, you know, third year is really when you blow it out. And when we look at how we jump to other ecosystems, it's through the app partners, solutions partners, and the customer base of HubSpot. So we haven't really had that breakout moment yet. We're growing very well, but it hasn't really, HubSpot as a platform hasn't really had that breakout moment yet. So our plan is absolutely to jump to Salesforce, but we have such a strong position inside HubSpot still. And to your point, there's still a lot more meat on the bone that we can still play in this ecosystem for a long time. And it's kind of our playground in a way. Like we're in such a strong position that we're not losing out to anybody here. And we're not losing out to other people making meaningful progress in other ecosystems where we feel like we can't overcome that with better strengths launching us there. The HubSpot like acquisition question is always funny because I think, you know, founders and other VCs just assume that when you're focused on one ecosystem, you're just trying to set yourself up as an acquisition target. And for us, it's really downplaying the strategic like intentions that we've had by focusing on one ecosystem. Like you mentioned, there's so much benefit to being focused. We punch way above our weight because we're a 9-person team, you know, focusing all on one ecosystem. We actually like are on the same level in HubSpot's ecosystem as PandaDoc and Aircall and Wistia and these other partners that are much bigger and much more mature. But we stand out because we have this obsessive focus. So for us, it's actually not beneficial for HubSpot to come buy up one of their leading partners. And they know that too. Like they're not trying to compete with us. And I think people look at the platform plays as risky because they think that, you know, the platform can just build into you and into your category and crush you. And it's just not true when you have advantages that you've learned over a long period of time, like all the AEs and CSMs knowing your brand and knowing your content, like they're not going to be more effective at selling the internal lighter weight version of it than your own, you know, more powerful version that they know how to, you know, bring in your sales reps to help close. So either way, for us, it's been an awesome kind of early learning of like, or for us, it's been an awesome like mechanism for like learning how to go to market in one ecosystem. But we know it's not just like a rip and replace and we'll go grow in another ecosystem. We really have to like get to the point where we can leverage the existing partners here to go jump to others, but it takes time. So we're patient with it, as I think the other benefit of being lean and focused.
Yeah, that's the bit of the frustrating thing is when you do make the jump to another ecosystem, you can't use the exact same playbook. You'll be able to use some of it, but you know, you kind of have to start from scratch a little bit, like building all those new relationships. Like it's impossible just to like replicate and duplicate exactly what you did. But the benefit,
at least what we've seen or what we've planned is, you know, we are building relationships now and advantages now that we can leverage as we go to other ecosystems. So we won't be starting as we did 2 years ago as like a tiny team with no, you know, little of no revenue and no customer base and no partners. We'll have a lot of that. But we do, at least, you know, back to Avanish's advice, it will still take multiple years to see the like true momentum of the new ecosystem. So I think there's a natural tension there of like, to your point, there's a lot more meat on the bone in HubSpot, but we can't wait too long because Otherwise, you're really delaying the momentum you're going to have by jumping to other ecosystems.
Yeah. I want to underscore that great advice again, that it takes 3 years to start seeing the fruits of your labor in a partnership. And again, like, this is widely applicable to any SaaS company, whether you're, you know, platform or ecosystem agnostic. Like, if you're doing any partner or channel sales, I think we get all obsessed with like net new partners and signing them and maybe doing a webinar together and announcing it on a blog post. And then, you know, we go hard at it for 4 months and then nothing comes from it. And we're like, all right, move on to the next one. And that's just wasted effort. When in reality, like, go deep with 5 partners instead of trying to sign 50 over 3 years. Go deep with 5 and you'll have much better success.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's totally true. And I mean, early on, you know, the first 6 months were definitely us going like, why isn't this working faster? Even now, we're like, why isn't, you know, everything happening faster? And it's just a constant reminder that, like, you know, it's a balance between like being short-term and patient, but long-term patient. Like, we have to be patient over the long term for this really to, you know, grow and ripen. But at the same time, we have to do activities in a very focused, iterative way, like having dozens of calls with AEs and CSMs each month. You know, if you don't do that, the 3 years doesn't matter. It's not 3 years of no activity, right? It's 3 years of very persistent activity, but it takes a while. And I think that constant battle of just saying the same things, spreading your messaging, talking about how you help customers, mentioning where you fit in, you just have to do that hundreds or thousands of times for 3 years. And then at some point, the machinery of the platform ecosystem really starts to kick into gear. And, you know, it's a swelling of brand meets, you know, flywheel, et cetera. All these things in that ecosystem start to click, where you get mentioned in marketing campaigns, you get early access to certain APIs and programs, you get relationships that start to happen where people internally mention you and they go, I know them, I've met them. And that sort of stuff happens over a very long period of time. But you have to be, you know, show up consistently every week for that to ever get to that point.
Showing up every day for 3 years, you'll be surprised what will come of it. Even like, you know, we started GTM Fund now just about three years ago. And I guess like our ecosystem is like the VC landscape, the startup landscape. And, you know, early days, we'd have to tell the GTM Fund story every single time that I met a new founder or investor. And now I'd say like 75% of the calls I get on, like, oh, I've heard of you guys through X, or I'm reaching out because I heard you from Y. And
some founder friend I know really liked you all.
Yeah. Which is huge. And then you're just like the power dynamic going into that call is so much like, you know, in your favor, which is huge.
Actually, I think that's been a big learning for us too, is, you know, 2 years ago, 18 months ago, the type of energy I would show up, you know, with to a call with anybody at HubSpot or a partner was very different than the energy I show up with now. And we're very conscious of that. You know, we can't be the scrappy underdog, like, eager energy that we were then, because then we didn't matter. Nobody knew us. So we had to show up with that sort of energy. Now we show up and, you know, we have HubSpot CEO co-keynoting our event in a month. It's like, all right, we can't show up as if we're this like scrappy underdog anymore, because, well, we can get HubSpot CEO in our event, you know, and HubSpot's GM of Service Hub on our event. And, you know, that it's not true anymore. So even though we feel very similar and you're still a startup, or, you know, and you all being a scrappier fund, we still feel small. It's like, no, we actually have a different stature now, and we have to represent that stature properly, or otherwise people look at you or don't. They misconstrue what you're trying to get at. And, you know, it's this maturity that comes with it, where we go, okay, now we can show up and say, hey, PandaDoc, hey, Aerocall, do you want to come to this event with us? We're not the scrappy unknown company anymore. We actually, you know, can punch at a level that you are at. And that's been effective, I think, for us to like recognize that change of position in the ecosystem.
Totally. Yeah. It's really being, keeping your pulse on, like, as your brand evolves externally and people start thinking about you differently, you make sure that flows into the internal team as well. And like updating your own self-image, your own brand at Aeros when you're heading into those conversations. Super, super important. But I want to quickly shift gears a little bit. People love stories. People love, you know, hearing the nitty gritty of founder life. And I want you to tell me about one of the most impactful stories that you've gone through in your career. I know there was a time period where this HubSpot Ventures deal may not have bounced in the right direction. And talk me through kind of that period. I imagine it was incredibly stressful, and I bet you learned a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it was around the time we met you, or right before we met you, and you all jumped in on our round, which was, really confidence building. For us, you know, we started in March, April of 2022, building on the HubSpot ecosystem and launching their marketplace. We got to know the HubSpot Ventures team that summer. We saw them at Inbound, their conference in September. We built up this relationship that was just, you know, growing towards this investment in Arrows. They were really excited about what we were doing. We were a hell yes. They seemed to be a hell yes. And then, you know, at some point, we signed the term sheet with Gradient Ventures to move forward on the deal. And then what happened is the market is Facebook and Google and all these companies started laying off lots of people. And, you know, HubSpot's not a company that's investing out of a fund like GTM Fund does. It's actually investing off its balance sheet. So it became a very uncertain thing of whether or not they were going to be doing investments at that time. And possibly the Arrows deal was going to get caught up in that. And so on like a Friday afternoon, I found out that there was possibility of the deal not happening. And we had made a full company bet at this point that, you know, from me and my co-founder down to our whole team, everybody knew that we were all in on HubSpot at that time. And we didn't need the money necessarily at that moment, but it really, really would, you know, help us out. And we knew that the deal wasn't necessarily going to turn into some magical promotion, but it really would legitimize us in the ecosystem and legitimize us with the you know, customer base that we were trying to sell into. So from my mind, I was like, I need this to happen. And for our team's mind, like it would have been, you know, everybody thought and assumed it was happening. So for it to not happen was going to be something that really would, you know, be an emotional challenge for, I think, a lot of the team to overcome. Like, what does this mean for us? What does this mean for this focus? We made this really big, risky bet to focus on one ecosystem. We have to make this happen. And so by Sunday, you know, that weekend, we were pretty confident that there was a large risk of it not happening. So I bought a same day red eye ticket to Boston. I'm in LA, flew across the country. Right after I bought the ticket, shot them a note saying, hey, I'm going to be in town. I'll be there all week. Like, when do we meet up? You know, I didn't buy a way back. I was like, either I'm going to Boston, we're going to make this happen, or I'm going to have to like take a train down and we'll go to New York and I'll find some other investors to fill this round. But we'd already had a signed term sheet. We were not with them, but, you know, with our round that they were going to come in on. And there was a lot of momentum going. We're going to do this. We really want you involved. You're not just some like side piece here. It's like, we actually really need HubSpot involved in this. And, you know, what happened was that energy of, I'm showing up, we're serious about this. Like, you're important to us. This partnership is important to us. I ended up in their office that week a couple times. You know, I was emailing executives that knew us about how important it was to get this done. The Ventures team knew that. And, you know, they were very bullish on Arrows, but there's a lot that had to happen to make sure we could get the deal approved. And I think across the org, there's enough of that, you know, this team shows up sort of energy that, you know, built up some confidence that we could get the deal done. But also even for our team, you know, I got on our Monday morning, like team kickoff, and all of a sudden I was in a hotel room in Boston and had to share with them why I was there. And, you know, I think for them, it was a very strong indication that, hey, like we put the work in and like this is important to us and like we're going to show up as founders and make sure like we do the hard things and make the hard decisions and get on the last minute, you know, red eye to make sure that we all can like see the, you know, reap the benefits of this like very hard, risky bet that we all made on this ecosystem. And, you know, I think when I look back, like that's one of the things that was the most painful and challenging kind of weeks or months as we were dealing with that and trying to pull off the deal that we thought maybe was going to fall through. But also kind of one of the things that really makes us look back and go, oh, we have a lot of grit that, you know, we're proud of and that we think can will be the reason why we're successful at some point is like because of those sort of moments where we know we just have to go show up and put the effort in.
Man, I love those stories. Never underestimate the power of a fake business trip. Being like, hey, I'm coming. I'm in this city for XYZ reasons. I'll be there all week.
Oh, and just, but like, it was like, oh, I'm coming there to see you. Like that was the one with this one. It was like not even the fake one. It was, no, I just booked a ticket because I'm coming to see you and I want this to happen. And, you know, I think that that's maybe an under, even compared to the fake business trip, another underutilized version of this is like, you're so important that I'm flying there to see you, you know, and like, I actually don't mind. I don't think that's like a loss of leverage. I actually think it's a thing that should help you realize how serious we are about this. You know, I'm not coming there for any other reason. I'll have other meetings, sure, but like, I booked this ticket because I'm coming to see you in person and that's important. You know, what's $1,000, you know, ticket and hotel room worth to a company? It's worth a lot if you can make sure you pull off like that relationship that you need or that meeting you need.
I love it. The conviction that people want high conviction. They want people that are willing to go above and beyond. So yeah, making that happen. And like, yeah, I agree. That stage in the relationship where it's so far along, totally okay to be like, listen, I'm booking a flight to see you. Sometimes earlier on in a process, if you're just
you have to play to know it cool.
that can be a little much for people. Although I would do it all the time if it didn't kind of give weird flags. But I love it, man. All right. As we sort of, I guess, what do you think? Was it like purely just market dynamics that made that happen? Or have you done some self-reflection? Like, would you run that process any differently?
The fundraising process?
Yeah.
I definitely think we were underprepared for that process because, you know, the deal really came together because HubSpot wanted to work with us. And then our existing investors were thrilled to lead the round because they really liked what we were doing. But we never ran it as a process. So like when I met you, we were really trying to pull together just some extra folks. But really, you know, if I had been more prepared as a founder, we would have run that more solidly as like an extension or, you know, seed process and made sure that we were more prepared because when we wanted to go fill out the rest of the round, we weren't able to fill it out as well as we intended to. And we actually thought, we assumed that HubSpot being invested in the focus on HubSpot was going to be more compelling to investors and it wasn't. And I'm unsure if that is their own perception of the ecosystem at the time and maybe even still now, or like us not, you know, messaging the strategy well enough, and probably a bit of both. But I really feel like we could have overcome that and gotten more people involved in the round and excited about the round had we prepared and run the process as if we were running a true fundraising process. I think we're very fortunate that you, for example, got it. We're very excited and already kind of paying attention to HubSpot and liked and resonated with our messaging. But you know, that was more a testament to you and your kind of preparedness to meet us than like us necessarily being great at running that process.
What I see with our founders and founders I talk to, like, even if you have the best metrics, you can be a second time proven founder, like everything can be right. And if you're not intentional with your process, like it is not going to go the way you want it to. You know, there is a numbers game. People personally like connect with people differently. They connect with ideas differently. And, you know, it's kind of just like, you know, you can have the best product and the best solution out there, but if your go-to-market motion is lacking, then you're not going to make it happen. So kudos to you for, you know, still getting some incredible investors together in the round without being overly intentional. And you know, I'm excited to see you raise future rounds and happy to, yeah, excited to help you with that. But final two questions, my friend, final two questions. This has been super fun. First question is, what is one widely held belief that founders believe to be true today that you think is bullshit or no longer serving us?
One that comes to mind that's interesting. And, you know, we draw on a lot of Jason Lemkin advice, but I think a lot of the advice around hiring your early go-to-market team, particularly early sales reps, you know, there's the whole notion to hire two sales reps, hire some BDRs for them, etc. We've been, you know, I think big proponents of trying to find the right people find that right early founding member that is the right person to bang their head against the wall to help you figure out the process. I think as founders, we put a lot of weight on our own shoulders to be the ones to solve everything. Go hire the two sales reps so you can pit against each other. For us, it's been, we did that and it was a mistake. And then we found the right one sales rep that has helped us really develop our sales process and our sales motion in a way that was, just a lot more right for us. And I think there's a lot of advice out there like that are rules of thumb that are very easy to pull off the shelf. But a lot of founders just pull that stuff off the shelf and then apply it to their business and kind of don't realize or really understand why it's that advice or why it does or doesn't work for them. So it's really about, I think, kind of unpacking the advice that exists and understanding if and being intentional about why you should apply it to your situation or not. And for us, we were able to reassess of like, no, actually hiring two more sales reps. It wasn't like the two reps are wrong. It was like, we just don't need two people that we just throw into this process. We actually need the one right person who we can develop this with.
So I'm almost hearing like the widely held belief that is false is like there is unanimous tactics. Yeah, tactics or strategies that work. Like you have to take the time to be like, okay, why has this worked for people in the past? What is it getting at? Instead of just like blindly, you know, putting the tactic to use.
Yeah. Every playbook worked at one point for some company, but it doesn't mean it'll work for you.
Yeah, totally. On that, people are always looking for silver bullets, things that are working. What is one go-to-market tactic or strategy that's working for Arrows right now?
At the risk of sharing something that we, I think of as pretty clever and is working decently well, but SEO is very hard and, you know, like the Salesforce opportunity, very hard hill to climb. And especially when you're focused on an ecosystem like HubSpot, where there's a lot of ownership over keywords. Arrows is doing video, a lot of YouTube video, because it's in many ways different than LinkedIn. It's actually like an owned channel. It's not like an email address you own, but it's close. You need subscribers and whatever, but you also get a lot of search volume from Google and from YouTube. But what we found is you can actually, you know, there'll be 10 links for HubSpot links, and then there'll be three Arrows videos right in the middle when you search on Google. And so in a lot of ways, YouTube and video is a side door into Google search. And, you know, and it isn't like an ephemeral channel like LinkedIn or Twitter where your posts just go away. It's actually something that you can own. And so, you know, we found that to be a very great channel for us.
Super smart. I love that. I think I need you to chat with our VP of marketing, Sophie. We're going in on YouTube. We had a pretty good YouTube channel back in the day with Sales Hacker, but it's been dormant for a while, but we're kicking it back up. So would love to pick your brain on that. Anyway, man, appreciate you. This has been super, super fun, man. I always leave with a ton of notes. Anything else you want to highlight? When is this event happening that you have the CEO of HubSpot? And congrats on landing that. That's insane.
Yeah, it's ilovehappycustomers.com. So it's the Happy Customers Festival. It's Arrows talking about with a bunch of other app partners in the HubSpot ecosystem. So PandaDoc, Aircall, Wistia, Reveal, Grain. We're talking about how the best in apps in the ecosystem go to market together on one platform. So HubSpot's the connected platform. You run marketing, sales, success there. When you plug in these great apps that have deep integrations, it really allows you to connect them all across the customer journey. So Arrows kicks off an onboarding process after you sign a PandaDoc. You know, and that syncs in the status. Wistia allows you to go to market with partner data via Reveal. And, you know, it becomes a really powerful motion when you connect great apps into one ecosystem.
I love it. Well, I'll be checking it out and just excited to be on this journey with you, man. Thanks for taking the time today. And of course, to our listeners, I always say it, but listening's one thing. You know, executing is something totally different. Hopefully some of these tactics, strategies, stories will prompt some thinking and some results on your end. And we'll see you next week.
Awesome. Thanks, Scott.